Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
While a lot of people will do walking, the thing that people aren't doing is strength training. And if you want to be jumping out of your chair when you're 90, then you need to keep your legs strong. And it's one of the absolute, you know, best protective things you can do to keep things going for the longer term.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. One of the greatest gifts of being a doctor for older adults is the constant reminder that life is fragile, finite, and precious. That is one of the sentences taken from my next guest's book called Staying Alive. Dr. Kate Gregorich is a geriatrician and internal medicine physician. She works in both acute hospital medicine and community settings and has completed a PhD looking at the impact of positive psychosocial factors in the development of frailty in older adults. And we have a conversation today all about looking after your parents and looking after yourselves with the goal of looking after your health in older age. Lifestyle medicine is a core feature of Kate's clinical practice, and nutrition, exercise, and sleep are obviously integral to developing plans to optimize her patients' health. And her approach goes beyond physical by working with people to identify their own priorities and values. On today's show, we talk about how to balance the need to change health behaviors to improve longevity with the need to enjoy today. We also talk about the importance of social and emotional well-being in any definition of health, the perspective of a geriatrician and actually what a geriatrician does in hospital, assessing someone's readiness to change and tips to motivate them. We talk specifically about sarcopenia. Now, this is a subject that I don't think gets enough attention, and it's something that is a big, big problem in older age adults. So we define it and we talk about mechanisms to try and improve it. We also talk about the prescription for healthy aging. And this is a teaser, squats, purpose, and plants. And you'll know exactly what that means later on. And also the impact of loneliness and how that activates a stressor response. This podcast is for information purposes only. I do highly recommend that you share this with loved ones and also friends and family that you feel that could benefit from it. Please give us a 5-star review and comment as well. We try and go through all of them. But without further ado, here is the podcast with Dr. Kate. Kate, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, that's good to hear. So we were first connected when I spoke at one of the lifestyle medicine conferences for Australasia, and you were comparing the session. I just wanted to ask you about the current state of lifestyle medicine and what the general consensus is amongst medics in Australia and that part of the world, and how you got involved in it as well.
Yeah, I think Lifestyle medicine for me is absolutely essential to the way I practice medicine. And, you know, lifestyle medicine is a kind of new and fancy term for something that we've been really doing for a very long time. And, you know, I'm a geriatrician, so I'm a specialist for older adults. And the person who founded Geriatrics was a UK physician called, I believe, Marjorie Warren. And her amazing contribution to getting people better was to get people out of bed and to see what mattered to them and get them moving. And, you know, it's such a simple thing, but it was revolutionary at the time. And in my day-to-day practice, the thing I love about being a geriatrician, I get to work with this amazing team, with physiotherapists, with dietitians, with social workers. And we don't look at making things perfect for our patients. We look at saying, what really matters to you and how do we achieve that? And, you know, sometimes there's a bit of some misperceptions about lifestyle medicine, that it's very alternative, that it's not mainstream, but it is absolutely integral to the way I practice medicine at a very large mainstream hospital.
Yeah, I love that about Marjorie. I had no idea she was almost like, you know, the founder of geriatrics, and the simple act of getting people out of bed and moving was sort of the core. I mean, it makes so much sense. And just for those who don't know what a geriatrician does on a day-to-day basis, why don't you give us a little insight, a window as to what geriatrics is and what your day-to-day is?
Yeah, so I'm a medical doctor and I am a physician. So we do the same early training as cardiologists, gastroenterologists, as endocrinologists. Then I've sub-specialised in geriatric medicine. And my day-to-day varies a lot depending on my day. I work in acute general medicine, so people who've just come into hospital unwell. I do some work in the community, which is really great and often so much more about, you know, helping people really thrive in where they want to be. I do some work in rehabilitation. I do some work in perioperative medicine. Basically, I get to work all over the place. And that's one of the things I really love about my job.
Yeah, it's awesome, because I did a bit of geries when I was training to be a primary care physician. I did old age geriatrics. I did, old age dementia, old age psychiatry, as well as general medicine. And it is amazing just how diverse this field is, because on the face of it, you know, geries is just defined by, okay, we're treating people over a certain age. I can't remember what it is in Australia, but over here, I believe it's 65 plus, or depending on what hospital you go to. But that population just have such a diverse range of medical conditions, but also social circumstances as well. No 80-year-old is the same as another 80-year-old, although medicine sometimes inappropriately classifies them. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and that is just such a huge part of what my job is. And, you know, by the time someone's 80, they've lived a life. They've had various different education. They've had different work. They've had different financial situation. They've had different relationships and life experiences. And all of these things come together to create someone's health status at this age. And so, yeah, no two people are the same. And we do have generic cutoffs related to age, but two people who are 80 can be vastly different ages. You know, we've got leading politicians who are 80. And some of my patients are in their 50s and they've got geriatric issues. And sometimes it's to do with, you know, bad genetic luck, but far more often it's to do with what's happened to them in their life.
Yeah. So what compelled you to go into geriatrics as a specialty yourself? What were your early experiences with the medicine?
Look, it was a slight accident at the time. I'd started off training as a rheumatologist and I had my first baby and I was on maternity leave and I wanted to go back, and there was a part-time job in geriatrics. And I absolutely loved it once I started. I love that I get to work in a really holistic way. I love that I get to work with an interdisciplinary team. I love that for my patients, it's not about, you know, making one aspect of their care perfect. It's really patient-centered care, and it really integrates not just medicine, but also a lot of the social things going on around them. I also get to work with really, really great other clinicians. I think geriatricians tend to be very nice people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Actually, one of my fondest memories working with a geriatrician was how they were fastidious on having a tea break mid ward round, and I loved that. Everyone sat around, you know, everything stopped, you know, obviously outside of emergencies, and that sort of like homely, family orientated feel of the geriatric wards was really nice. And I think, you know, getting to know some of the most incredible people, the incredible life stories of our patients is amazing. And I think Jerry's, particularly in the medical field, has got this inappropriate chip of it being, well, just old people who are grumpy and you just throw some medications out and everyone's got blood pressure issues or mobility issues, you walk around the ward and that's it. We oversimplify it. And I think, you know, that this is just so complex.
Oh, it is. It's so complex. And that's, again, one of the things I love about it. You know, the physiology of aging is so complex, and then seeing how that works out in someone's life. And, you know, the thing as well about my patients, and it's one of the lessons that I take from that and apply to my everyday life, people have got this real wisdom when they've lived a lot of decades. And people, you know, resilience is a learned skill and tends to go up with age. And when I say to my patients, you know, what's important to you? No one has ever said to me, I want to live as long as possible. They all say things like spending time with my family, work, doing this charity work that I do. It's always something about human connection, something about helping. And, you know, it's such an important thing for me to keep mindful of in my everyday life.
Yeah, let's talk about that, actually, because I'm interested, given your extensive experience being a consultant in geriatric medicine, what are the key learnings that you've had from patients themselves? What are the key things that have you've picked up by speaking to people that you've put into practice in your own life?
Yeah, definitely the importance of human connection. And, you know, health, well, we often have such a reductive approach and it's all about the physical, but social and emotional health are just as important as the physical side of it. And that means human connection. And that's been something which unfortunately lately has been lacking just because of all the restrictions around COVID. And it's really brought home to me how important that is to helping people recover when they get sick. The other thing is that happiness isn't about, you know, material possessions. Again, I've never had any of my older patients say to me, I'd be happier if my house was bigger or if I had that designer wallet. It's always, you know, one patient I remember saying to me, I want to get better because I want to go dancing with my wife again. And they were in their 90s and they'd gone dancing for the last 70 years. And I think the other thing as well, when I see people who are doing really well in older age, they're still curious and they're still learning. And people sometimes have this perception that as you get older, you lose the ability to learn new things, to have new ideas, to contribute. And it's just not true. You know, there's so many examples of people doing fantastic things in that area.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was chatting to Dan Levitin about the aging mind and stuff, one of the things that we talked about was how aging almost needs a bit of a rebrand. Life, you know, from the perspective of a 20-year-old or even a 30-year-old, sorts of seems to stop age 65 when you retire. But in reality, like you said, you know, a person who ages well is someone who still maintains their curiosity, is still excited to learn new things. And that actually has some benefits to cognitive health and physical health, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a huge part of that is purpose. And the research around that is so interesting. People have got a higher sense of purpose. It is actually protective against dementia. And it's also protective against cardiovascular mortality. And I think it's when people still feel like their lives matter, they still feel like things are important, they take care of themselves. But I do suspect there's also some biological positive impacts from that.
And when it comes to the reality of actually trying to instigate a lot of these things, and we'll talk about a few more in terms of nutrition, the microbiota, but how do you cultivate purpose from the perspective of someone who is from that older generation, perhaps has some ingrained mannerisms within themselves, or someone who's listened to this who might be middle-aged as well, how do you cultivate that feeling of that human connection, that purpose, and spark that curiosity?
Yeah, and it can be really challenging, especially if people have got strong preconceived ideas. One thing I do is I always ask my patients what's important to them. You know, what matters to you? What do you like to do all day? And try and frame things around that, because I think if things don't matter to someone, they're not going to make any positive lifestyle changes. And I guess as well with my patients, I do often see them with their sons and daughters who are in their 80s. And particularly if the parents have got age-related diseases, those sons and daughters are often extremely motivated to make some positive changes themselves.
Yeah, and you know, in a ward environment, let's say you're discharging someone, and you know, how do you tap into that readiness to change, and how do you actually cultivate sort of that energy for them sometimes? I mean, you spoke about, you know, what motivates them, what inspires them, but you know, I'm just trying to think from the perspective of someone who's listening, who might have grandparents and they are limited by their mobility, they're limited by their connections and their ability, particularly right now as well. What kind of things have you come across that might be insightful for those people who are trying to look after their parents as well as look after themselves as we grow older?
Well, I guess when they're leaving the ward, they're often very motivated to change and do everything they can to get home. Being in hospital is an amazing motivation. No one wants to spend time with us, and I get that. It's fine. But yeah, around the home, I think as well, I think often the biggest thing is helping people overcome ideas about what they can and can't do. And, you know, a lot of my patients in their 80s, I get some pretty I get some real looks when I tell them they need to start doing exercise, especially doing resistance training. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, to their credit, they listen, they go and see the physiotherapist, they do their exercises. But again, it's just about framing it for things that matter to them.
Yeah. And when it comes to, let's say, diet, and you're trying to suggest to someone who might have been eating the same thing, or you know, has a particular taste and they're reluctant to change, do you have any sort of top tips or things that you've been successful with when it comes to trying to instigate changes for the benefit of their health and mental well-being?
Yeah, it's really it depends on the group. So with my particularly frail older adults, it's often more just about getting those kilojoules in. But when people are a bit younger, when they've got a bit more sort of scope to make positive benefits in the longer term, you know, I think one of the big things about diet, and I'm sure, you know, you know more about this than I do, but I think one of the big things about diet that gets missed as well is that enjoying food needs to be absolutely central. And that so often gets lost, and we make healthy food sound, you know, awful and reductive. And for anyone at any age, if they're wanting to make positive changes, it really does need to be framed as, you know, making food that's really tasty.
Yeah, yeah. And within the context of them actually being able to cook food as well. I mean, a lot of patients that I've come across, you know, they do have carers, they do have support mechanisms that they have to rely on. And trying to fit that within the context of what is achievable for them is quite challenging as well. Are there things that you've developed perhaps in your practice, or even things that you've come across within the community that can help with improving the nutrition of the increasing aging population that we're going to be dealing with now and in the future?
Malnutrition is actually a huge issue in frail older adults, and you know, I've even seen things like scurvy, which you know, you just don't expect. And when people are socially isolated, perhaps they live alone, they've got limited financial resources, and again, they don't have that motivation to cook for themselves. You see some people who live on very restricted diets, and it's often just trying to meet people's really basic nutritional needs. And it can be a very hard thing. You know, we've got certain programs where we can get Meals on Wheels, like food delivered, we try and get families involved. But for the most vulnerable, the biggest issue is just meeting basic dietary requirements.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I remember learning during my nutritional medicine master's was about the aging microbiome. And you've talked about this in your book as well. I should mention the name of your book. What's the name of your book again?
Staying Alive.
Staying Alive, okay, aptly named book. But you talked about the aging microbiome and what happens during that. And I wonder if we could just double click on what happens to the microbiota as we age, why that happens, and what kind of things we can be thinking about in terms of additions to our diet, but also the suite of lifestyle interventions that we have to mitigate against the reducing diversity of that population.
Yeah, so exactly as you said, the diversity reduces with older age. But even more than that, there's a study that came out of Ireland quite a few years ago, and it showed that people who were frail living in residential care had a less diverse microbiome, and they had different predominant bacterial species to people who are more robust and living in the community. Now, with this sort of thing, it's really hard to prove chicken or the egg, because often in residential care, diet isn't great. But you know, it's highly plausible that with the reduction in diversity of the gut microbiome, with the changes in the predominant bacterial species, that you are getting an increase in exposure to harmful bacterial products. And this could be potentially a driver of frailty, because frailty is itself associated with immune dysfunction and inflammation. And so, you know, we need more research in this area, but the way I take it is that I think it's all the more evidence just to keep eating your vegetables, eating that huge diversity of plant fiber and, you know, the stuff that our garden and our gut needs to stay healthy.
Yeah. Do you have any perspectives on supplementation, specifically probiotic supplementation, vitamin D and even protein supplements as well?
So with the probiotics, there's some evidence for constipation in older adults. I guess my kind of reluctance with probiotics, a couple of things. Number one is that you're only looking often at one or two species, comparing that to a super diverse gut microbiome. The other thing is, I don't think taking a probiotic, you know, you can't grow a seed in concrete. So a probiotic's not going to replace giving your gut microbiome all that fiber that it needs.
Mm. I love that analogy, a seed in concrete. I'm going to borrow that one. That's a good one. And with vitamin D, which is commonly low in the older adult population, do you have a suite of sort of things that you tend to look out for? Or
look, not particularly. Vitamin D is so complex, and we supplement when it's low, definitely. There's not convincing evidence for giving vitamin D routinely to everybody. And with vitamin D, again, it's really interesting. I use, you know, one tablet once a day usually. Giving people intermittent high doses is actually linked with falls. There's been a couple of studies looking at that. So giving like monthly high dose vitamin D seems to increase falls, and it's not entirely clear why. But again, with bone health, I think that the approach around that has often been a bit reductive. And, you know, we have this thing of we give vitamin D, we give calcium to get the bones as strong as possible. But, you know, bone is a living dynamic tissue. Bone has a very good blood supply. Bone responds to the stresses going on around it. And so diet is one part of it, but you've also got to move. You've got to stress the muscles. You've got to keep all of that strong to tell the bones to keep turning over and keep making new bone.
Yeah. On the subject of bones and musculoskeletal health, I wonder if we could double click on sarcopenia. I don't think it's talked about enough from a nutritional point of view, mainly because people who are perhaps interested in nutrition and well-being are of a younger generation, and they haven't come across sarcopenia until perhaps one of their, you know, grandparents is taken to hospital or they become immobile for whatever reason. Could we describe what sarcopenia is, why it's so troublesome in the older community, and what kind of lifestyle, nutrition, and other interventions we have to try and treat it?
Yeah, sarcopenia is a really large problem in older adults. And in countries like the UK and Australia, the biggest cause of later life disability is actually inactivity. And again, that relates to sarcopenia. And so a lot of factors contribute to sarcopenia. So disuse is a big one, but it's also related to obesity. It's related to diabetes. It's related to, and there's a lot that we can do to improve it. We touched, I think you mentioned before, protein supplementation, which I then didn't follow up afterwards. And a low protein diet in older adults is linked to worse outcomes. And, you know, I do see a lot of people who are having a poor quality diet, and part of that is not enough protein. But again, there's no good reason you can't get all the protein you need from food. And it's highly achievable to get it. But it's just that for various reasons, some people can't quite manage it. But with that, it's always my preference to try and get things through food. But the other part of sarcopenia is to do strength-based training. And that's something that I think the earlier you start, the better. And, you know, particularly women, we often think of strength-based training as, you know, young guys getting giant muscles in the gym. But, you know, really it's women who start off with a lower peak muscle mass than men. And that plays out in older age with osteoporosis and with, you know, sarcopenia to the point that they're struggling to get out of a chair and end up in a nursing home.
Yeah, yeah. When it comes to, there's a few concepts there. So there's malnutrition, there's immobility, and there's also changing taste buds and reduced secretions that can lead to food or the enjoyment of food not being as pleasurable as it once was before. Are there any strategies that we have to overcome those? And what do we know about changing tastes as we get older?
I guess, look, seeing with my patients, it's most people still have foods that they really enjoy. And I remember even one patient I had, and she had a stroke and she had a nasogastric tube in, and she wouldn't eat enough of the hospital's various soft foods and thickened fluids to maintain her nutritional needs. And so, you know, we started to get the family to bring in this really creamy rice pudding. And she just would eat so much of it that we got the nasogastric tube out. And so, again, people can find things they enjoy. And it's really keeping sight that even in, you know, really advanced age, even in really advanced dementia, that pleasure in food is often one of the absolute last things to go.
Yeah. And when it comes to oxidative stress, inflammation, these things that underpin a lot of the lifestyle-related illnesses that we see, is there much we can do for that in the age group above 65, 70 years old? Or do we really have to be focusing on the foundations today before we get to that stage later on when it might be harder to change?
There's definitely still evidence that, you know, even starting to exercise later in age is good for you. You know, meeting your nutritional needs is good for you. But the reality is, for most of the patients I see, they've got very established disease, and they've got diseases that had their genesis decades earlier. And I think we really do need to start thinking about what we want our lives to be like in the future at a younger age. And I guess it's how you make that matter to people in a really concrete, present way for something that's really abstract and a long way in the future.
Yeah, yeah. On the subject of that, so one of the things that I always get kickback on is whenever I talk about sleep and how, you know, getting a good quality duration and the actual quality of the sleep itself is super, super important when it comes to improving longevity, improving performance, reducing stress, oxidative stress, inflammation. But for the older generation, it is so hard, and it appears to get harder as you get older. What do we know about sleep in older age, and is there a role for other treatments for sleep, and are they as effective? I'm thinking of things like CBT and other supplements as well for insomnia.
Yeah, when I do talks to groups, older groups, the sleep is often where question time goes. That's what people want to know.
Yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's certain physiological changes that happen with older age that can make it a bit more challenging. So we normally get a surge of melatonin that helps us go to sleep. But for older people, they'll often get the surge a little bit earlier and it's not quite as strong. And so you see these people who doze off in front of the television at 8 p.m. at night and then they can't get to sleep. It's also hard to get into really deep sleep with older age. So people can be more easily woken up by things. But there's still a really important role for lifestyle changes. And, you know, that's still my first go-to for people is, you know, with sleep, it comes from the time you wake up in the morning. And so it's talking through that entire day of routine. Are you getting enough exercise? What time are you stopping drinking coffee and tea? Are you drinking alcohol in the evenings? What's your wind down routine? You know, how do you get away from the stress of the day? all of those things that are playing in together. And I do sometimes prescribe melatonin for people as well. And I do also sometimes recommend people see a psychologist for cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah. Do you find CBT is particularly effective for insomnia in older age groups?
Look, the evidence would suggest that it is, but sometimes some of my patients, and not all, but some of my patients have got a lot of negative perceptions around psychology. Sometimes I think it's a bit of a thing in the older age group that they're not so keen on it. Some people have also got just intractable habits that they aren't willing to budge with. At least so much you can, like the patient who gets up at midnight and has a cup of coffee.
Yeah. There's only some things that you can change, and if they're not ready to change that, then
but definitely for the people who are willing to engage with it, it's definitely something. And I guess the one caveat with that is people with dementia itself seems to upset the sleep process, and for that group sometimes we do need to use more sedating medications.
Is it true that we need less sleep with age?
It is not true. We still need our 7 to 9 hours of sleep. So it's a myth that people need less sleep. It remains just as important for a young adult as for an older adult. And, you know, I'm very into sleep, having had a lot of experience of sleep deprivation, thanks to my children who are not good sleepers. Sleep for me is an absolute priority because I know how much worse my brain works when I haven't slept. And it's one of these really good examples that, you know, again, we think about doing things for our longevity as putting it off for the future. But sleep, you get enough sleep, your day now is so much better.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because it's a constant struggle, even with my parents and my parents' friends. When I try and convince them, I said, look, you 100% need the same, if not more, sleep than I need. So this whole myth that you can work on 6 hours because you're of an age group now is, you know, it's just simply not true. So I'm glad that we've done that. And I think also we had to be careful about the use of pharmaceuticals from an early time before instigating lifestyle measures. And, you know, we really have to get that foundation in before we start thinking about pharma, because I feel that that leads to a vicious cycle. And I have a lot of people that struggle to get off those different interventions as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I've got patients who've been dependent on benzodiazepines for 40 years because they got started on them back, you know, in the 70s before anyone knew they were addictive. And now they're at a point where they can't really get off them. And, you know, long-term benzodiazepine use is actually linked with dementia as well. And they work at first, then they stop working, and then your brain just learns to accept them and to crave them. So I use them exceedingly rarely.
Yeah, although that's good to know. And I think a lot of people should be aware of that. You know, it is a drug. It exhibits tolerance and withdrawal effects, and we want to be using them much less frequently than perhaps we have done in the past. I want to ask you some broader sort of questions about how you would design you know, the sort of perfect geriatric lifestyle for someone who's trying to, you know, maybe geriatrics has got a bit of sort of triggering term, but perhaps for my parents, for example, like what kind of things should we be telling them in terms of looking after their diet, their sleep, and the best sort of lifestyle hacks that you've come across in your years of experience in dealing with older patients?
Yeah. So I guess if I've got to choose, I mean, number one, I can't choose just one thing because, you know, lifestyle is, these things all build on each other. But if I guess I've got to choose one aspect of each thing. So with nutrition, I would just say, you know, try and make sure most of your plate is plants. You know, crowds out everything else, crowds out the ultra processed foods. You know, I definitely don't advocate for a really rigid approach to diet, a restrictive approach to diet, but just, you know, instead of keeping it really simple, try and eat mostly plants. Number two, in terms of exercise, while a lot of people will do walking, the thing that people aren't doing is strength training. And if you want to be jumping out of your chair when you're 90, then you need to keep your legs strong. And it's one of the absolute, you know, best protective things you can do to keep things going for the longer term.
What kind of exercises?
Strength and resistance training. So basically, moving your muscles against a load. So it can be body weight or it can be weights. And as we get older, we lose what's called fast twitch muscle fibers. And these are the fibers that, well, you know, when you think of a sprinter, but it's also when you stumble on the street, they're the things that kick in quickly to stop you falling down. Yeah, and doing that also loads the bones. The bones then get the idea, oh, hang on, we need to work here. And so it also encourages bone strength. And the study showing that people who do long-term resistance training, you decrease your risk of osteoporotic fractures.
That's a really interesting point about the fast twitch muscles, because a lot of what I see in the emergency department when it comes to older patients is falls. So, you know, the simple stumbles, the simple, you know, the curb's a little bit higher, the irregular floor, perhaps the furrow on the end of your walking stick is slightly damaged and you don't realize, and then that leads to a tumble and that can lead to head trauma and it leads to an extended hospital stay. And unfortunately that can sometimes be the straw that breaks everything, and it leads to a catalogue of errors later on. And I think, you know, protecting our ability and our ability to remain mobile using leg strengthening exercises is a fantastic, fantastic tip. Are there specific leg exercises that you find work better or easiest to attain?
I mean, you can even just, for some people, just simply practicing standing up out of a low chair without using your arms and doing that a few times a day. But generally, you know, squats are great. But generally for people, if you're not as young anymore and if you haven't done resistance training, I'd recommend finding an experienced and skilled trainer. I don't know if you have exercise physiologists over in the UK or physiotherapists, but it's not about working out to the point of exhaustion. It's about working out in a way that you're using proper technique, that you can still do the exercises properly and expecting to build your strength slowly.
In terms of sort of cultivating that sense of a purpose, I guess, and community, are there things that you've come across that are particularly effective?
Yeah, and this is, you know, something I learned from my patients. And the ones I see are the ones who've got these really meaningful social connections. And I think it's, loneliness is an interesting thing, because some people are quite, they like solitude and it doesn't cause them stress. But for some people, it's that feeling of disconnect. And I know some people, and they live with other people. They might live with a spouse and they still feel really lonely. And when we feel lonely, we activate all those neurological and hormonal stress responses that over the longer term can be so harmful. And so it's really not about, it's about quality, not quantity.
Yeah. Yeah. Loneliness, I think, is coming to the public knowledge these days about how impactful it can be to not just mental well-being, but physical well-being through the mechanisms that you just described there, activating stress response pathways and inflammation. It's one of the hardest things I feel to try and tackle from the perspective of a primary care physician with 8 or 9 minutes per patient. You know, we might be doing a home visit. It's not like I can prescribe something to treat loneliness. Are there any things that you've come across in your clinical experience, but also perhaps outside of that, that can try and help with this chronic loneliness that we're experiencing these days?
Oh, look, I think it's really hard, and especially because loneliness is a stress state, and then people who tend to be in that state tend to be sort of a bit hyper alert and even less able to connect with others. And, you know, I think really in a lot of ways, this is where, you know, social determinants of health and the individual, you can't pick them apart. And it's one of the problems we have in our society that we sort of, people who are frail and older often are hidden away. We don't have them. We don't see people out and about very much. You know, we all live in these houses, and we've set up this really individualistic society that really falls down when someone hasn't got the same ability to get out and access it that they used to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been no more apparent than of late with obviously lockdown and the inability of people who are already poorly mobile but have to shield being able to go out and stuff. So I think we need to find more effective functions of trying to treat loneliness these days. And technology can be a force for good from that perspective. I mean, the very fact that we're having this conversation across hemispheres is amazing.
It is. And, you know, we've had to really readjust to how we connect. But there's been some positives in getting more used to doing things over Zoom as well, you know, get used to seeing people you wouldn't normally see far away.
Yeah. I've definitely had that experience with some of my friends. Well, look, this has been awesome. I think, you know, those are some really incredible top tips for people. And I think, you know, having the knowledge is one thing, but putting it into practice practically as a geriatrician, as someone who's trying to look after the health of their parents or trying to promote health to their grandparents even. I think your book and the content you put out there is super useful. So thanks so much for that.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to break down this idea of health as this, you know, future thing. Like so many of the things that you do that improve your chances of longevity are actually better for your well-being in the present. And a lot of ways refocusing on well-being in the here and now, I think, is a really powerful way to improve that longer term health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think when you get to a point where you have children and you're thinking about the future, you want to try and preserve as much of that amazing human experience that you have with your loved ones. We can start thinking about how the lifestyle interventions can fit within that picture of you being healthy and and full of vitality well into your 70s and 80s. And I think, you know, we need to reframe the way we think about aging to as something to look forward to rather than something that you have to deal with tomorrow, you know, at a later date in your life. So,
yeah. And now that most of us can expect to reach very old age, you know, it really is time to completely disrupt the way we think about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. Just to reiterate exactly what we talked about, squats, purpose, and plants. I think it's a really good three-word summary of the whole podcast. And if you want to find out more, do check out my guest on socials. You can check out all of her links on the podcast page, thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast, and also check her out on Instagram and the amazing book Staying Alive. It is an amazing manual for healthy aging, both today and the future. So it's definitely a resource for your parents or loved ones who are of the older generation. I hope you enjoyed listening, and I will see you here next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.